It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, schools and other organizations worry about the possibility of mass shootings. But what if there was a way to prevent the violence in the first place? We'll talk to the author of the new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. First, over the weekend, the Biden administration directed Immigration and Customs Enforcement to clear low-priority immigration cases. The goal is to speed up processing of higher-priority cases involving public safety or national security threats. The move could clear the largest ever number of cases from the court docket. As many as 40% of the current 1.7 million case backlog could be eligible. We're talking about changes in immigration policy under President Biden, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this immigration court backlog? Find it confusing? You're not alone. If so, call in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of trying to prioritize the highest priority cases? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. Aaron Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
So there's a lot going on here. I kind of want to take this a step at a time. First, we have this backlog of these 1.7 million immigration-related cases. How did the backlog grow to be this big?
You know, it's a number of factors, but we've certainly seen it grow through the pandemic when immigration courts were generally closed most of the time, especially for cases that were not detained, so people not in prison during the process of their case. And so the backlog just continued to grow and the case processing times continued to grow as well.
And who are we talking about here? Who are the people in this backlog and how did they end up there?
You know, there are a number of different factors and a number of different people that are involved. So when someone is in this backlog, they're in what's called removal proceedings. And that's a proceeding where the government is deciding whether the person should be removed, or more commonly termed deported, from the United States. Some people are placed into removal proceedings after having issues with law enforcement, or some people are placed into removal proceedings after crossing the southern border and asking for asylum. Some people are also placed into removal proceedings for simply being in the United States without authorization. So there's a variety of people that are in this process and for different reasons.
So here we have the Biden administration saying, okay, as one step to try to clear up this backlog, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, should clear low-priority immigration cases. First, from what we know from the administration so far, what do they mean by low-priority cases?
So they haven't defined low-priority cases, but they've defined the cases that they'd like to concentrate on. So if someone is a case is involving public safety, so maybe someone with a criminal conviction or a national security issue, so terrorism or something like that, that would be of concern, or families that have recently crossed the border to come to the United States. So those are gonna be considered the higher priority, but the lower priority cases are then, we can assume, are people that maybe are just in the United States without authorization, but have had no issues with law enforcement or any sort of security issues. And they may even have family that are US citizens, including children. But in order to process through the immigration proceedings, you generally will go through, need to qualify for a form of relief from deportation. And some people simply aren't eligible, even if you have U.S. citizen children. So in certain cases, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement attorneys, can use their discretion to administratively close those cases so that they're not taking up space on the docket. The individuals are not a danger to society, and they can stay in the United States, but it doesn't mean that they can stay permanently or that they even have a work permit. So it's not a huge benefit, but at least they're not going through the immigration proceedings and won't be deported.
And now this policy comes as the administration expects a larger number of migrants potentially starting next month. This is when public health rules that have been used to limit immigration, public health rules related to COVID, are at least expected to end. Can you talk about that change and the impact it could have?
Sure. So, yeah, Title 42, which is a way that the United States, a law that the United States used to close the southern border to pretty much everyone, even those seeking asylum, due to the pandemic and the danger that the CDC had determined was present with people crossing our southern border. The CDC recently announced that because of the vaccinations and other mitigating factors, that danger no longer is around. So people will now be able to process on the southern border. So we look at the past 2 years, over 2 years that Title 42 has been in effect and has closed the southern border. Now, all those people that have been waiting for 2 years to attempt to seek asylum in the United States, many of them attempting to seek asylum and refuge, will now have the opportunity to do so. So it will be a large number of people, and it sounds like the Biden administration is attempting to prepare for their arrival.
Talking to Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School, looking at Biden administration changes on immigration policy, border enforcement policy, including this effort to focus on what they say are higher priority cases that are currently in this massively backlogged immigration court system. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question, if you have a thought on what you'd like to see from the Biden administration and or Congress on these issues, maybe a personal experience to share of yourself or a friend, a family member, someone you know, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With this massive backlog in these immigration courts, Aaron, how long are we seeing people's cases take to go through that system and get a resolution to determine whether they're deported or not?
That's a really good question. And it appears based on information from Syracuse University, their track system, that it's taking about an average of 5 years for people to process through the system when they're non-detained, so they're not in jail during the process of removal, which is a very long time for certain people, especially if they have a strong form of relief and they're simply waiting to be on their pathway to citizenship. So in certain cases, with the work that I do, we've had to ask for expedited hearings, which is difficult to obtain. But when we have clients who are desperate to receive asylum, which means that they will have a pathway to citizenship and may allow them to reunite with their family, it becomes a priority, because 5 years is a very long time for people to wait to know whether they have safety and refuge here in the United States.
And what's their status in the meantime? Can they legally work, for example?
So it depends on whether they have a application for relief pending. So there are different ways to kind of fight deportation, is how we see it, relief from deportation. And one of the most common ways is applying for asylum. There's also something called cancellation of removal for people who've been here for over 10 years, if they're not lawful permanent residents. So if they do have possibly eligible for relief, they may be eligible to have a work permit, but not everybody is eligible to do so. And it takes a while, at least 6 months, to receive a work permit once you have filed an application with the immigration court.
Now, with this prioritization that the Biden administration is calling for from ICE, saying, hey, let's focus on the high priority cases, clear some of these lower priority ones, the numbers of people potentially eligible are estimated as high as 700,000. About 40% of the current immigration cases in the current backlog could fit this low priority standard. But it seems like people see a very wide potential range of who actually would end up in that category. What are you looking at?
You know, when I saw this announced, you know, I thought about some of our clients that we've been working with for years who, one in particular who doesn't have, he's not eligible for any relief from deportation, but he's been waiting for his final hearing for about 7 years now. But he's been in the United States for close to 20 years, has worked hard, and never had any issues with police, and has family here. But the family that he has here are not eligible to apply for him through the immigration system, because it's very difficult to find pathways to citizenship. So I think about him, someone who's been in the United States for a long time, has worked very hard for a company, and his employers want him to stay, but he has had the looming fear of being deported for the past 7 years. And I believe that this new policy may allow him to remain in the United States, not in a status where he has a pathway to citizenship, but at least where he can stay, where he has in his home.
Erin Barbato is with us, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School. She's helping us sort out a Biden administration directive aimed at resolving low priority immigration cases. Those make up about up to anyway 40% of the current 1.7 million case backlog currently in our immigration court system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on this policy or other things you've seen from the Biden administration when it comes to immigration and especially the southern border? Is there a policy change you would like to see made one way or another? Do you have a question for our guest about how all these systems work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the Biden administration's changes to the immigration system with Erin Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Still time for you to join in, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on immigration policy in the United States, changes you would like to see made or reversed. Call 800-642-1234. Or if you have a personal experience with the immigration system, if you or someone you know sought asylum in the United States, love to hear that perspective. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Erin, suppose I'm someone in one of the Central American countries that are providing a lot of the people seeking asylum here. And I say, you know, I want to go to the United States. I want to immigrate. I want to go through the full legal immigration system. I don't want to risk trying to cross and claim asylum because that seems pretty touch and go. What is that process like?
Oh, it's extremely complicated and limited. So generally for someone to immigrate to the United States, meaning to come here permanently, they would need to qualify through family-based connections, which mostly is a very close family member, spouse, children, parents, or employment-based permanent immigration, but those types of visas are incredibly difficult to obtain as well, and are really only saved for some of the best and brightest people in the world with the most accomplishments. Then you may be able to, the other category, so family, employment, and then we look at humanitarian-based reasons. So if someone may be eligible for asylum, meaning that they have a fear of persecution or have been persecuted in their home country because of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion, they may be able to seek asylum in the United States. But there is no just way for everyone to come to the United States. It's very specific categories with very long lines and high eligibility categories.
And those asylum categories you just mentioned, there's been some back and forth in the U.S. on what constitutes a threat that allows you to make a successful claim for asylum. And I'm thinking again in these Central American countries where people are fleeing organized gang violence or threats to their children, that isn't always treated as something that's covered under those asylum categories, right?
That is correct. It has become more difficult to obtain asylum based on gang violence or persecution by gangs, especially after the Trump administration. But in certain cases, you may be eligible, but it is a very difficult category to qualify for asylum under.
Another change, and correct me if I'm not understanding this correctly, another change the Biden administration is looking for, I think, is to say, for these asylum claim cases, we're going to try to resolve this by allowing basically officers at the border, asylum officers at the border, make the decision as opposed to having that case go through into this backlogged immigration court system. Do I have that right, first of all? And if so, what does that mean?
Right. I think that's a great summary of what the intention is. And so whenever anyone arrives at the southern border and they want to seek asylum, they will arrive at the southern border, present themselves to Customs Border Protection, and they will not have the right documents to come into the United States generally. So they will be placed in what's called expedited removal proceedings. At that point, if the person expresses a fear of return to their home country, they will then be offered an opportunity to prove that they have a credible fear of return. So it's an interview with an immigration officer. If they pass that credible fear interview, generally they're then placed into removal proceedings. But this new process will allow asylum officers to process people for asylum. So what it seems like to me is people with very strong cases will be able to receive asylum quite quickly. And those that don't receive asylum from the asylum officer, they will then be placed into removal proceedings and present their case in front of an immigration judge. But instead of it taking 5 years, it will happen within 90 days. So it's a much faster process, which is beneficial for some, and I worry for many others.
Right. And I've seen concerns that it would offer less opportunity to get legal representation in that expedited case.
Exactly. Having legal representation is a game changer in the immigration system. It's incredibly difficult to process on your own, and even with an attorney can be incredibly difficult. But when if everybody's being processed at the southern border in these clandestine locations, it's going to be very difficult for people to have any sort of access, not only to an attorney, but to trusted information.
We're talking to Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW Law School, looking at a handful of changes coming from the Biden administration related to the U.S.-Mexico border, immigration, claims of asylum, and more. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Aaron, I know there's concern from some people like with this low priority designation, in effect, allowing people to stay still in a gray area in the United States. Republicans in particular expressing concern, well, is this going to, in effect, invite more people to seek to cross the border in hopes of getting into that same situation? Do you have that concern?
You know, I don't have that concern. What it seems to me is that the Biden administration was really hoping to have a pathway to citizenship for many of these people. But in order to create that, Congress would have needed to act to create a law to allow people who are undocumented without any issues with law enforcement or security and have been in the United States for a long time to have a pathway to citizenship, even if they were in removal proceedings. But that hasn't happened. So now what they will be left with is if they are taken off of the immigration docket, the deportation docket, then people may be able to stay in the United States for some time, but they don't have any pathway to citizenship or any benefits that will make their life that much better besides being able to remain in the United States and remain with their family. So it's not a huge win for these people because they'll still have to live very much in the shadows, and policies can change with administration, which we have seen. So our next president can change the policy and these people could end up right back into deportation proceedings. So they live with a fear of deportation regardless of the situation.
Let's bring on a caller. Jody is with us in Downing. Jody, hi.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm in support of this. I think we should be going a lot farther and having a pathway for citizenship as well as temporary visas. I work with nonprofit in Guatemala, but I also am surrounded by farmers that are, all their staff are these undocumented workers that, you know, we need the workers. Everywhere you go, there's help wanted signs. We need the workers. It only makes sense, and I hope that they can expand it beyond this. Thank you.
Jody, thanks for the call. And Aaron, I just saw the Wall Street Journal reporting a big part of our labor shortage in the United States, in part is related to a big drop in legal immigration in recent years. Is there room, a need for more work-related visas?
I believe so. I think there's a need for more pathways to citizenship and also temporary visas for people who would like to come here seasonally or for a few years. But that will take Congress to act in order to change those policies generally, and they just haven't done so yet. But Wisconsin businesses and agriculture definitely depend on immigrant work for documented and undocumented people.
Thanks for that call. Aaron, I've talked to you in the past about your work with the Immigrant Justice Clinic, trying to gain access to people at the border to give them legal representation. What are some of the biggest challenges you're facing in the last year or so?
Well, the pandemic has created a number of issues for accessing our clients and also for being able to process cases through the immigration courts because they have been closed. So a lot of our clients have just been waiting quite a long time. However, we have been very much involved with the people that have arrived from Afghanistan and lived at Fort McCoy, and are now, many are processing for asylum here in Wisconsin. So we're working a lot with them and planning some trips to the border to provide additional access to information for people seeking refuge there, as well as a trip to Germany this summer to work with people seeking refuge in Germany to learn about the process for Ukrainians and Afghans over there.
And as we wrap up in our last minute or so, Erin, what is the biggest unanswered question for you right now when it comes to U.S. immigration policy?
I think how the biggest question for me is, how are we going to come up with a humane solution that really is ensuring that people who deserve safety under our laws will have the opportunity to do so? So many people have been forced to remain outside of our borders for years under the Trump administration and then due to the pandemic. So I'm really hoping that the Biden administration can come up with a plan to ensure that people have access to justice and safety under the laws in the United States.
Erin, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Erin Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She talked to us today about President Biden's directive to resolve lower priority immigration cases in the backlogged immigration court system, along with other changes in immigration policy that may be on the way. Coming up after the news, law enforcement officers, criminologists, school officials, and others are teaming up to try to prevent mass shootings. Learn about the latest efforts at risk management. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Trigger Points. Remember, you can follow these conversations anytime online at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app, listen live to our networks, and download and share archived audio as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW Oshkosh is using food scraps and yard clippings to create electricity. Now they want to use it to heat a building on campus, too. We'll hear about the environmental impact of the school's biodigester program. Now, mass shootings disappeared for a while in the early days of the COVID lockdown, but they returned as schools and businesses opened back up. For schools and organizations grappling with this, some have taken the approach of increasing security measures, putting metal detectors in place, or doing active shooter drills. What if, instead of increasing security, we could prevent mass violence in the first place? Our next guest spent years reporting on an approach that's shown some success with a tool known as behavioral threat assessments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more focus on how to prevent mass shootings? Do you see this kind of threat assessment going on in your school, in your community, maybe in your workplace? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Mark Fullman is National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones. His new book is called Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we get into threat assessment, you say right off the bat, you're not writing a book about guns and gun laws in particular. Could you talk about why you didn't focus on guns and gun laws as part of the solution here?
Sure. Well, of course, we have to acknowledge that mass shootings inherently involve guns. But I have been investigating this issue for the past decade and done a lot of reporting as well on the political debates over gun violence and gun laws, investigated those topics. But for me, this project and the pursuit of this book was about really going beyond that to see what else we could do to try to solve this problem, because those debates that we have vigorously over and over again tend to go around in circles. And you know, the battle over gun laws is an important one. It's an essential issue to dealing with gun violence, of course. But I became convinced years ago that there had to be more we could do to solve this problem. And when I started learning about the method of behavioral threat assessment as an additional solution, I found it very interesting and potentially quite compelling. And that's what set me off on the path of writing this book.
And you've spent years talking to people, the pioneers of behavioral threat assessments, people putting it into practice around the country as well. Can you give us the basics? What is a behavioral threat assessment program?
So essentially, this is a method that seeks to intervene ahead of a person who is planning an attack like this. And that's an important thing to point out at the outset here. We have a big myth about mass shootings that these are, they're treated as impulsive crimes. Mm-hmm. You always hear the question, what made the guy snap afterwards, as if this is an impulsive act. But that's not true at all. The case evidence makes clear that in every case, this is these are people who are developing an idea for violence, are planning it, are taking steps to prepare, and are then carrying it out. And as a part of that, they are also giving off a range of behavioral warning signs. And that is the heart of this work. It's a collaborative model that brings in law enforcement and mental health expertise primarily to evaluate a person of concern, to look at a more holistic picture of their circumstances and behaviors, and identifies patterns within that to evaluate the level of danger. Is this a person who's thinking about and planning violence, and does this person have the means to carry out that violence? And in answering those questions through the protocols of this method, then a threat assessment team is able to develop a plan to intervene and to manage the situation with the goal of trying to divert the person away from this violent thinking and this violent planning onto a better path. Because these are often people who are having a lot of problems in their lives, right? A lot of mental and behavioral health issues.
Now, when a mass shooting actually does happen, we'll see it in the news. When a behavioral threat assessment works, it's probably going to be a success we don't hear about. You highlight, though, some of those success stories, including you touch on an example in Wisconsin where these methods may have prevented a mass shooting. Can you share a little of that story with us? And I understand you can't release very particular details.
Sure. Yes, there are quite a lot of these cases around the country in recent years where threat assessment teams have successfully gotten in the way of and constructively worked with individuals to prevent them from committing violent attacks. And it's a really interesting concept in the sense that the results are sort of proving a negative, because you're talking about a successful case is the absence of a violent outcome. It's the absence of evidence. So this isn't news. This doesn't make news stories because nothing happened in that sense. So there is a case from Wisconsin that I talk about early in the book in brief. And, you know, a lot of these are sensitive. So this was one where I can't share details of where it was or who it was. But it was a high school student who had been talking about the possibility of a shooting at his high school, referring it to it kind of obliquely, but kind of fixating on that over time. And this came to attention of authorities doing this work. It turned out the student also was carrying around a notebook with a list of his enemies, what's known in this field of work as the hit list, people that he said, quote, he wanted to eliminate. This is a common signal in a lot of threat cases, and in particularly with school shootings. He had also said to a friend as the team started to gather more information around him by talking to his peers and his teachers, a friend reported that he had talked about something big, quote unquote, about to go down later in the week at a school assembly. So through these various indications, the team became sufficiently alarmed and moved to intervene and get him help to try to steer him away from this violent thinking.
Talking to Mark Fullman about his new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, can you talk about what this process looks like? Let's stay in the school setting a little bit. A school where the community has been trained in these kind of things, what kind of steps do they start to take when they first get those warning signals, like the ones you were just mentioning?
Sure. So the contours of that case I was describing are common. There are many school threat cases like this that have gone on. And I write in the book at length about a program that I was able to immerse in out in Oregon in the city of Salem. The Salem-Keizer School District there was one of the early pioneers of this model in a school setting. They built a program after Columbine in 1999. There had been another very traumatic school shooting in Oregon the prior year in Springfield. So they were very focused on this problem. And the field of threat assessment had just begun to really develop a focus on school shootings specifically. It originates with some other forms of planned violence, assassination and celebrity stalking and workplace violence. But after Columbine, there was intensive focus on schools. And so I was able to spend a lot of time with the people who built the program in Oregon and had a lot of cases over the past two decades where they've been able to intervene with students like the one I was describing from Wisconsin, who were giving off these behavioral warning signs, indications that they may be thinking about bringing a gun to school and committing a shooting. And the way that they intervene foremost is to step in with constructive measures to try to help a kid in crisis. In Salem, they call it their wraparound strategy. They extend lots of close personal support. They try to create tighter connections with trusted teachers that a student may like, give them counseling, give them independent educational support, try to work with the family, which isn't always possible. There are tough family situations in a lot of these cases, and you may have parents in denial or hostile even to the idea that this is going on with their child. But by using this kind of broad range of constructive interventions, they're able to, in many cases, successfully help steer a troubled student onto a better course.
Another element that you talk about in the book is what some of the experts call leakage, a very common apparently for people who commit mass shootings to have told people about it in advance. What kind of training comes as part of this threat assessment to the community, whether that's a community of students or at a workplace or maybe even an online community?
Right. So that term leakage refers to one of the sort of areas or categories of behavioral warning signs known as threatening communications, the ways that perpetrators signal their intent through, and it takes various forms, comments to peers in their talk, but also in writings in many cases, in journals, and of course, in the digital media age, online, on social media. And signals like this are not in and of themselves predictive of anything. There's no one thing that tells you someone is planning a mass shooting. But where this becomes highly relevant is when a person is raising concern in people around them, causing anxiety and fear. And the need for public awareness of that combined with these kinds of behaviors is helpful to this field because it's more likely to be reported. So we just had a pretty traumatic example of this again last fall in Michigan with the Oxford High School mass shooting. There were a number of peers of that perpetrator who were worried about things he had been posting on social media, but didn't speak out or weren't taken seriously. So I think to your question, it's about building better community awareness of what these things mean and also having the community know that they can turn for help to a program like this.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Interesting topic. Really looking forward to reading the book. My question is, based on which study you read, somewhere between 30 and 70% of perpetrators of mass shootings have a history of domestic violence. So I'm curious what opportunities there are to sort of intervene there. And I guess for anybody who has experienced that or is experiencing that specifically, is there something that they can turn to possibly prevent a mass shooting?
Mike, thanks for the call. Mark?
It's a great question. I'm glad Mike raised that because the field has learned over time about a whole range of factors that feed into this problem. And domestic violence is one of them. It's significant. So when that comes up in a case, it's an important data point, an important signal. And it speaks to also the plans they can make to manage a case, to intervene. If there's a domestic violence issue going on or a person has problems in that territory, that's going to inform how they're going to approach handling that person and trying to help that person. And in some cases, this does develop into more punitive response. Not every person is going to be responsive to constructive interventions, but many are. And there are many cases where it can be effective, including with that issue.
Thanks for that call, Mike. We're talking to Mark Fulman, National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones. His new book is Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about threat assessments being used to stop mass shootings, hopefully before they come to that point? What questions do you have about how they work? If you work in education or law enforcement, have you been through a training like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with journalist Mark Fulman about his new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. He looks at the growing interest in threat assessments, behavioral assessments that that help prevent shootings, maybe help people reach out to the potential perpetrator and prevent it from happening in the first place. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, you write about kind of a contagion or copycat effect, often going back to the Columbine shooting you mentioned earlier. You have some ideas on how we in the media can talk about these shootings. And you point to an example I want to listen to. This is New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern talking after a shooting at a mosque in Christchurch there in 2019.
He will face the full force of the law in New Zealand. The families of the fallen will have justice. He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety. And that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist, he is a criminal, he is an extremist, but he will, when I speak, be nameless. And to others, I implore you, speak the names of those who were lost, rather than the name of the man who took them.
Mark, could you talk about the value of that approach?
Yes, that was a very compelling moment after that horrific event in New Zealand a few years ago. And it was hopeful because it showed progress in that case, in a high profile public official responding to a mass attack. The case research of this field and my own research as an investigative journalist into the problem of mass shootings has revealed an extensive trail of perpetrators who seek notoriety, who want media attention, sensational media attention. And so that presents, I think, a unique opportunity to make positive change with this problem too. The media doesn't cause anyone to commit a mass shooting. However, if people have that as a source of inspiration, it tends to exacerbate the problem in many cases, with what we also know as the so-called copycat problem that you mentioned, that primarily grew out of Columbine, but now extends to other high-profile attacks whose perpetrators that others identify with. And so I looked into this quite a lot several years ago and did some reporting on it for Mother Jones, and it's in the book as well. I arrived at an idea that I call strategic diminishment, because the flip side of this is also not tenable in my view. There's been a movement to completely black out the names and identities and images of shooters, but there's a strong public interest that the media has to serve to report on these attacks. I think the reasons why are obvious in terms of the impact, but also to combat misinformation. There are a number of examples of cases going back many years where people have been misidentified in the immediate aftermath as the perpetrator, and that has consequences. So the media has a role and a duty to report on these cases in the public interest. And what I mean by strategic diminishment is really striking the right balance to kind of shrink the frame around the perpetrator and only report what has meaning and value to understanding what happened and understanding this problem better. Beyond that, we look away We don't focus excessively on the sensational or salacious details of the perpetrator. That used to be a much more common practice in our media. And the good news here is that this has changed a lot in recent years. I think the media understands better now that that's not good, that that can have bad effects. So we're not plastering their faces all over the front pages anymore. This is a good thing.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi. I guess basically I have a comment. You know, I've raised two kids, and they were raised around guns. And I grew up in a, a gun culture. When I'm 55 years old. We took our guns to school for English speech and didn't have any problems. I think we have to look at what has gone on from back then to now. You have social media, which has definitely been adding to it, and also both parents working. At one point, you had a parent home all the time while one person worked. So I think we have to look at how society is today and how it was, because we didn't have these problems before.
Tim, thanks for the call. Mark, a lot of the shootings we're talking about, of course, happened before there was social media.
That's true. I think what the caller's getting at is an interesting point in the sense of how it does point to kind of broader cultural questions we have about this problem, cultural and political questions. What is it about our society that has caused this to continue and to escalate in a number of ways? And I think the speed and reach of digital media is certainly part of that equation, as we were just discussing.
Sure.
In terms of prevention work, the practical approach to this is really about evaluating the specific circumstances and behaviors in any given case. So we live in the world we live in now, and that's really what the work is all about.
Thanks for that call. Mark, you mentioned a myth earlier about the, you know, impulsive snap decision to commit this kind of violence. That's not how it works, you say. Another myth you tackle is that this is mainly or entirely somehow a mental health problem, a mental illness problem.
That's right. And those two myths are very closely entwined. The notion that mental illness is the cause of all these attacks is fundamentally wrong. And that's the way we tend to talk about it in the general public and in the media, that mental illness is what caused someone to do this. But when you study the cases, it's just simply not true. Most of these cases do not involve perpetrators who have clinically diagnosable mental illness. Now, these are people who have a lot of mental health problems and life problems, behavioral problems. They're going through tough stuff, and they are dealing with it in an unhealthy way. But that's not the same thing as what we take that to mean in a lay sense. These are not people who are crazy, who are hallucinating, who are hearing voices telling them to do this. That fundamentally misunderstands these cases. Even in cases where there is significant mental illness, that's rarely a primary cause. So the question then is, what is it that is driving people to do this, and how are they acting? And by trying to blame it all on mental illness, it just sort of lets us all off the hook to make it this other, but it's counterproductive and it's wrong and it's damaging. It's stigmatizing. There are many people who do have those diseases who would never turn violent. There's lots of scientific research showing that mental illness is not predictive of violence.
In just our last couple of minutes, some of the things you're saying sound really hopeful, actually. If this isn't an completely unpredictable snap decision, if this isn't the result of some unfixable mental condition in perpetrators, that means, and I think this is the main point of your book, that these things are preventable.
That's right. And for me, the process of researching and writing this book over a number of years, it really drew me to that core theme, that really this is about demystifying this problem in a number of ways. We tend to talk about these as senseless tragedies that we can't explain. But for me, this became about making sense of them. And we can do that. That's what this field does. And that's how this model approaches it. So it's not going to solve the problem in its entirety, but it is a potentially very powerful additional tool we can use to prevent these attacks from happening. And that inherently is very hopeful and very optimistic. And I saw that too in the leaders and pioneers of this field, that to dedicate themselves to this work, inherently they have to have this kind of optimistic and constructive outlook on the problem. And so it's very uplifting to see all these cases that I write about in the book where they've succeeded. Again, they're not news because nothing bad happened. But when you go behind the curtain and enter this world of work, it is very hopeful for doing more to reduce this problem in our country.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Mark Fullman. He's National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones Magazine. He was with us today to talk about his new book. It's called Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. If you have worked at an institution that has done this kind of behavioral threat assessment, still love to hear from you. You can email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, find out why the IRS has trouble collecting taxes from the wealthiest Americans and check out a plan from the Biden administration aimed at raising the effective tax rate for billionaires in the country. And you can share your thoughts as always. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Even in the era of music streaming, a lot of people still love older musical technology. Vinyl records never went away. They've had comebacks in recent years. CDs are still around. Some bands put out audio cassettes, but that's nothing. A librarian in New York is ready to listen to some wax cylinders. As reported by NPR, those wax cylinders were the original medium for recording and even for home recording. And the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts has a collection donated almost 90 years ago with cylinders that are probably over 100 years old. In all that time, no one has listened to them. Why? Well, these things are really fragile. Even if you have the right equipment, listening to them might destroy them. The solution? Lasers. An audio company developed a technology that uses lasers and a needle to collect a digital read of the cylinders and then play them back. It'll take a couple years. What could be on them? Could be opera or somebody's birthday party? Could be a member of the media sharing unique and quirky news stories of the day. Wax on, wax off. This is Central Time.